On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
LA has the best Korean food, period. There's no debate about that. I still think New York is the best Koreatown overall, but, you know,
Well, it's in New York.
From New York, so there's no way you're going to take it out of me. I mean, it's the energy, it's the people, and I'm allowed to say this because my Chicago friends agree. The Koreatown in Chicago isn't as vibrant. Now you got to step it up, Chicago.
That's Dookie Hong. He's a chef, and he's also written a cookbook called Koreatown with food writer and friend Matt Rodbard. The duo spent 2 years on the road eating in Koreatowns across the U.S. Aside from discovering great dishes in Chicago, New York, and L.A., Dookie and Matt discovered Korean restaurants they loved in Georgia, Virginia, Texas, and Minnesota. They developed recipes from the food they ate for the book. Nice to have you here, gentlemen.
Evan, thanks for having us.
Thank you, Evan. Hi.
Hi. It's wonderful to have you here. How did this get started? Matt, you're not Korean.
No.
How did you fall into that rabbit hole of falling in love with the culinary culture?
It was my friend Jason Oh. Shout out to him. He is my best friend. We went to college together, and he is a really passionate Korean-American, and he cooked for me at his home, would take me to restaurants in New York City, and he was my Korean best friend, as I write about in Koreatown. You know, everyone has a Korean best friend, it seems, and he was mine. He was the gatekeeper who really just taught me all about the culture.
Yeah. Once you start eating, it's hard to stop.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Dookie, what about you?
For me, I like to associate myself with some always like unique kind of projects. And Matt brought it up to me. It was 100% Matt's idea. And, you know, he's like, let's write about Koreatown, not like Korean necessarily certain dishes or, you know, just a, you know, something made simple type of book, but more like about the people, the culture, a lot of the stories. So something, and obviously me being Korean, it was just close to home, close to heart.
It's interesting knowing your resume, which is incredibly impressive. You started at the 3 Michelin star Jean Georges the day after you graduated from the CIA.
Yeah.
I would imagine that part of you wanted to run as far away from Korean food as possible.
Yeah, it was really funny. So this was 7 years ago already. A lot of my friends, and there was a good amount of Korean people in Culinary Institute of America. Nobody was wanting to do Korean food. They weren't like, let's go open up the next Korean restaurant. It was, hey, let's go to the Daniels, the Persays, the Italian restaurants, the Jean Georges. So, I mean, I was incredibly fortunate to, number one, have a job and then have a job at a place like Jean Georges. So, yeah.
But then you've come full circle.
Yeah, I can't get away, you know.
Why would you really want to?
Right.
So let's talk about Koreatowns as places and the difference in character from one place to the next. Because I think here in L.A., it's so unique. I mean, Jonathan Gold famously calls it functionally a distant district of Seoul.
Mm. Yeah, it's like a foreign land to some who come here, but it really is familiar to Koreans. They see all the signs in Hangul. But Los Angeles is the beating heart of Korean culture in America, and it was the most important city for us to report on. And we're both from New York City, so we were on Delta a lot, you know, reporting this book. We went here 5 times. And really, we think of Koreatown as being not just a location, but a state of mind. You know, you go to Atlanta, Georgia, and you travel 35 miles north, and you're going to Duluth, which is just a very different Koreatown than in Los Angeles. You know, it's restaurants opening in these small strip malls that are abandoned, and really people are kind of scraping by, but the food is incredible. And then you go to New York, and you go down 32nd Street, which is the heart of Koreatown there, and it's vertically rising like you'd be in Seoul, and you've got 3 or 4 restaurants, you know, on top of each other, some specializing in soups and stews while others doing the barbecue. But, you know, we found Koreatowns in Chicago, in Houston, Texas, in Washington, D.C., and it was a big part of our journey to really dive into the culture.
Right. I mean, I think we always say that our book is very unique in the fact that Koreatown is written in the perspective of Koreans in America. And I think the different perspectives, because L.A. and New York is not the same. And New Yorkers will, you know, fight for theirs, and L.A. will fight for theirs. All the cities in between, Atlanta, Chicago, Virginia, like, you know, like, okay, there's like Koreans there, but you don't know how rich that culture is that down there. Atlanta, Georgia was probably something that surprised me the most, because it's, to me, it's considered the South. It's Georgia, you know, but Duluth, Georgia is a Korea, like a legit Korea town, you know, and one of the most beautiful H Marts that I've ever seen in my life is there. So
I'm curious, did you use a specific dish as a benchmark or a variety of specialty restaurants as a benchmark to declare that this is a Koreatown worthy of writing about?
A combination. You know, in Los Angeles, you're fortunate to have restaurants that specialize in a single topic, like samgyetang, for example, which is a ginseng and chicken soup, or gamjatang, which is a pork neck stew. And it's one of Jonathan Gold's favorites. And I went out with Jonathan and went to Hamchi Park, and we had a five-bottle soju afternoon, and it was pretty much epic. And we write about that in the book. But really, in New York, you're seeing restaurants that specialize in many things, and Duluth, Georgia, in many things. So it's difficult to judge a restaurant or a Koreatown based on one dish, because you know, most Koreatowns have all sorts of dishes. L.A. is unique. But I would say, with that being said, I judge a restaurant on their tenjang jjigae, personally, which is the bean paste soup and stew. I mean, that's the one dish that I like the most. And I think that really is indicative of a restaurant's quality.
Once you got to wanting to share recipes and entice people to actually make it at home, which I think is another whole difficult job, because here in LA, most people would say, well, why should I bother?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I can just walk out my
door.
You're
in your own
local.
And,
yeah. But I really, as a cook, I really believe you don't truly understand something until you've broken it down and tried to make it yourself. Did you focus on home cooks as well as restaurant cooking?
When we were developing the recipes, I come from the culinary background. Restaurants, you know, I know you come from the restaurant world too. So it's hard when basic what we think, quote-unquote, basic or, mm-hmm. or fundamental cooking knowledge is not basic or fundamental. So Matt, luckily, doesn't come from that world. So we had a very good back and forth about, hey, you know, he wouldn't even let me use a microwave on some.
Yeah,
like, everybody has a microwave.
It was my job was to transcribe his recipes in his in his home kitchen and then take them back to my small Brooklyn apartment and cook tenjang jjigae and gamjatang and try to make it work in a page or less, because that's what we were aiming for. It's challenging to cook some of these dishes. But with that being said, I found so many dishes that were a quote-unquote one-pot dish in Korean cooking. You get your jangs, your tenjang, gochujang, and the rest of the larder, you've got garlic, ginger, scallions, sesame oil, mirin, things that you're cooking with all sorts of Asian recipes. So we found you know, breaking it down was a challenge, and through our editing process, we were able to edit, but it was less challenging than I thought going into the project.
It was challenging. I don't know what you're talking about. It was really challenging, but I mean, for us, we didn't have any compromise. It was like, if you didn't have Korean chili paste, we weren't like, oh, go use like sriracha or something. No, it's like, no, if you don't have it, don't make the dish. Like, it's not worth making the dish.
I actually think that's the biggest commitment as a home cook. It's making the decision to give up some more space to bring in a whole other pantry.
Oh, I mean, look at Andy Ricker's book, amazing book, Pok Pok. That's a commitment. You have to go and buy galangal, like find galangal. This isn't an us versus them conversation. I just think, you know, the commitment for Koreatown to cook from it is lower than a lot of other cuisines of Asia. It's just the fact of the matter.
And once you have those pastes,
it stays there.
They're there forever.
Yeah.
I have to really say that you know, I have the miso and I have the
gochujang.
The gochujang. Well, the doenjang.
Well, tenjang is not miso. So as Roy Choi says, you know, you shouldn't call them.
That's true.
We can't say it on the air.
It's not miso. But basically, I almost don't use miso anymore.
Right.
You know, it's interesting.
how I feel about it. I mean, the only difference, and I get this asked a lot, what's the difference between miso and tenjang? You know, and, you know, it's very simple. One is inoculated with the Aspergillus oryzae, which is miso, so it's created. Tenjang is, there's no fabric. You need to let it sit, so it's natural fermentation. And then you get two different flavors. You know, miso has this distinct flavor. I actually don't even think they're very similar, to be honest. And, you know, it's easy to see it as similar because they're both similar in color. When you taste it, I feel like tenjang has just that deeper, rich, the months that it takes, you know, to ferment, it develops this rich umami, deeper flavor that I don't think certain misos have. So,
Okay, let's jump into cooking. Mm-hmm. What should people start with? Should people start with soups? Are they easiest? Or should people start, just jump in and make a kimchi?
Well, I think you should start with not just a kimchi, but a namul, which is seasoned vegetables. You know, kimchi is not the cabbage dish that many people assume is kimchi. That is beju kimchi. There are over 200 types of kimchi, and kimchis usually take between a day to a month to make. But there's a lot of other vegetables, just taking bean sprouts and boiling them and putting them and tossing them in a very small amount of seasoning.
Actually, that was a question for us. It was like, what recipe, if someone wants to pick our book, can they realistically do? I'm really proud of the quick kimchi recipe. You know, you just said it. You're like, do you want to step over to all the way to the kimchi? But for me, I'm like, oh, that's the starting point, because it literally takes 20 minutes, not even. Usually kimchis are, like you said, it could be a day, weeks, months. You know, there's kimchis that ferment for over 2 years, you know. So for us, our quick kimchi is, we have this like great base, and you can kimchi, as we said, kimchi is a verb more than a certain dish.
It's like taco.
Exactly, like taco it up, you know what I mean? Kimchi it up. So you like pineapples, you can kimchi that. Surprise us, whatever.
I think probably the first recipe I'm going to make out of the book is the white kimchi. Describe it.
So that's dongchimi, which is water radish kimchi. And it's inspired by our love for Los Angeles restaurant, The Corner Place, which is probably the best dongchimi I've had. I've been to Korea several times, and it's the best dongchimi I've ever had. It's a dish that's both sweet and sour. It's radish, it's water, and it's served at a corner place with bulgogi, and they're paired together magically.
Yeah, I mean, it's not served with, but you got it. It's like a pairing. Like you got this the you know, combination of cold noodles and hot meat. Like that cold and hot place is just incredible. But yeah, like I said, it's a Korean water radish kimchi, the combination of like funk and a good amount of sweetness, super, super refreshing. You know, when you come out of the airport, that's probably one of the two or three places. It's a coin toss between there or Sujita or whatever. But I mean, LA, corner place, best dongchimi in America, hands down.
And actually, the recipe is such a secret that they won't allow doggy bags.
Yeah.
They will not.
You can't take it to
I
go.
I thought that was hilarious.
Which is cool. I mean,
so you had to break it down by memory.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with the lemon lime soda
that's
in the recipe?
That's the quote unquote sweetness, how they do it. You know, like they don't, Koreans are very. They don't like straight sugar. Like you will never see a Korean, maybe, but you're not going to see most Koreans dumping like a load of white sugar into some dish. They'll try to extract sweetness from either natural fruit, you know, something like ginger ale or, you know, some Sprite. So the kind of the going joke in the secret, like, oh, because everyone's trying to find out what makes it so good. We believe that it's probably like 7-Up or something like that.
They would not tell us, though.
They won't tell us.
We asked.
They would not tell us. They'll just look at us weird.
It's so funny. Let's talk about banchan. Banchan must be an indicator to you of the quality of a restaurant, right?
100%. 100%. And Matt said for him it's the doenjang stew, which is a very staple Korean dish. For me, it doesn't even get there. If the banchan is, and not even like a flavor thing or, oh, did they put egg? Oh, well, like expensive banchan.
No.
Basic, like, is the bean sprouts fresh? Or has it been sitting and does it smell? Like, then everything else is indicative of what's going to come.
Everything falls into place.
So is banchan something that is really more of a restaurant presentation? Or if we're cooking at home, should we have a repertoire of, like, three banchan that we add to the side?
The great thing about banchan, it holds really well in the fridge. So like you just said, you know what, and Maddie said it too, you should start making some banchan, some kimchis, keep it in the fridge. I mean, you don't have to eat it that day or even that week, to be honest, which is great. And at the end of the day, at least what Koreans do, you know, they'll have some like 6 or 7 banchans in the fridge. Whether they make it or not is a different question. They'll have it, and all you do on a long day of work, you get a bowl of rice, take out 3 or 4 banchans, and just and then you're good.
That's called bibimbap.
Yeah, I mean, you don't even have to. I mean, if you mix it up in one bowl, it's bibimbap. You know, but you know,
we call in our book, we say this is not a bibimbap recipe. Yeah. You know, we don't subscribe to the idea that you have to have X amount of vegetables or X amount of proteins. We think that it is this dish that cleans out the fridge.
Yeah.
You make your one night, you make your Korean feast, and the next night you get Korean for the next. You know, it's this bowl of rice and beautiful things on top.
So you mentioned earlier the ease of making the bean sprouts with a little bit of sesame. So what would another couple banchan be that we could make from the book?
I like to think the soy eggs. I know it doesn't sound easy, but it's like there's – you make the soy, the base, the vinegar, the liquid, and then you, you know, either put some garlic, just fresh garlic, you know, because it'll cure in there. It'll pickle really beautifully there. And a hard-boiled egg. And you have really nice banchan. You know, like, what are some other... The spinach. Like, it's
Water
like...
water spinach.
It's really... And they're nothing so complicated. It's cooked whatever vegetable or protein and then season. Leave it in there and you can eat it a week later, 2 weeks later.
So since we're in Los Angeles, and I imagine that you've also explored the markets here.
Mm-hmm.
So which is the best market for banchan?
Ooh, markets? You know, I think honestly the best banchan we're finding is at Soban. Which is a lot. It's a restaurant. You know, the Koreatown Plaza has a good banchan shop in there. But but Soban is. We were just there last night having dinner, and I think it's one of the most elaborate banchan spreads you'll find in all of Los Angeles. You know, there's what was on their table. You know, we had
potatoes, a couple bean sprouts, burdock root.
Burdock root.
A lot of cool. It's a visual thing too. Like you've mentioned, it's not all red or all green, and you know, it's the first thing that you eat.
Yeah.
So. Definitely. I would say Soban, restaurant-wise, definitely Soban. There's a few other places in Korea. There's a place that, you know, there's a style of eating is 100 banchans laid out on the table.
See, like, I would love that.
Yeah, like literally, you don't even make it to halfway to the table. You know what I mean? You pick out, you get a taste of everything, it's 100 bites. So that's kind of one
called
style
baekbang,
of eating.
Right?
Literally means 100 dishes.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, I have to go to Korea. One of the things that you talk about in the book, which I find really interesting because I also do not have an oven in my kitchen, is that some Korean houses and apartments don't have ovens.
Yeah.
So what is the role of Korean pastries? Because they're kind of insane.
Well, you know, you're finding these cafes that serve Franken pastries, which are like hot dogs in a Swiss roll or Swiss rolls all these flavor combinations that you're not really expected. It's kind of like the way pastries have been translated through this Korean lens. It's like a lot of these iconic American staples, but with a little bit of a twist, like, as I said, the hot dog in the roll. But really, it's not about – cafes aren't really about the food in Korean culture. It's more about the socializing. And, you know, I think, Duki, you said once to me, when we were talking about the book, is Koreans are lingerers. So after a long meal...
Professional loiterers.
Professional loiterers. That's what you said.
I love that.
Loiterers and lingerers.
That was not a joke.
So when you go to these cafes, it's not necessarily like, this is the greatest pastry I'm ever having. Yeah. It's more like you want something interesting with your coffee and you want to sit and maybe recap the day or recap the meal. You know, Koreans are always talking about food. And that's why I, as a journalist, am so fascinated with this culture, is food is at the center of life.
I mean, it's crazy. People are talking about what they're eating while they're eating something. Like, oh, what do you want to go eat next? They're like, you're eating something right now.
I find that very Italian.
And that's such a great point. I feel like Koreans are a little bit more advanced in the tech world. So there's literally, it's called mukbang. So I pay you to watch you eat your food.
Yeah.
You think we're joking?
No, I've seen those
mukbang
videos.
This is the weirdest thing. Even as a Korean, I mean, I grew up in America.
Yeah, mukbang.
I don't know how to explain that to anybody. I don't agree with it. But hey, if you're making
food
money,
as entertainment, I mean, that's taking foodism to that next level.
Definitely.
So funny. Thank you so much for coming. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you, Evan, so much.
I look forward to getting into the kitchen with it.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much.
I've been talking to journalist Matt Rodbard and chef Duki Hong. Their new book, Koreatown, explores Korean food and culture across the U.S. Those quick kimchi recipes they were talking about, well, they're up on our website. Kimchi it up at kcrw.com/goodfood. Not to brag or anything, but L.A.'s got some pretty good Japanese food, too. That's next when Good Food continues.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman. The best-known izakaya in Las Vegas has put down roots in West Hollywood. Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, suggests it's definitely worth a visit. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we going today?
We are going to the new branch of Aburiya Raku in West Hollywood.
So given that it's a new branch, where was it located before?
Las Vegas, in the tiny Chinatown area on Spring Mountain Road. And it has, for the last several years, been the place that food people obsess about.
Right. It's the off-strip foodie destination.
Right. So after you've spent 3 days eating it, you know, Robuchon and Savoy and Osteria, whatever, then you go to Raku and have just really straightforward Japanese izakaya food.
Remind us what izakaya is.
Izakaya is basically a pub. It's a place where you go to drink and then to eat things that go with the alcohol. So at the Raku here, the other one too, but now we're talking about the one in West Hollywood, there's an enormous sake list. Most of the things you wouldn't have heard of unless you spend an awful lot of time thinking about sake. And sometimes I worry about that I end up like ordering things like Otterfest or Demon Lover or Three Dots just because they sound appealing.
Those sound like super hoppy beer names to me.
They kind of do, and sometimes I feel like they have the level of sophistication on sake as, you know, the people who go into supermarkets and buy the wine with the cute animal on the label.
But
anyway, Three Dots is a really good sake. I admire it. And there are many levels of Otterfest or Otter Festival or Otter Gala.
It's another rabbit hole to fall down.
It is.
But let's get to the food. When you go to an izakaya, I mean, it's like an original small plates place, right?
Right. It's kind of the format that all the small plates places are based on. You order for the table. Almost nothing is just for you, though this place has a very strong Robata Yaki component.
Which means?
Grilled things on skewers. And so it's possible to split up that slab of salmon belly that comes on the skewer, but you're not going to want to. That's your salmon belly, and you will fight for it.
Yeah, I find myself fighting for lots of things over an izakaya table. What were some of the highlights for you?
They make their own tofu, and it's very different from the tofu you get a lot of places. It's really well drained in baskets like you'd see with ricotta, and it has closer to a ricotta texture than it does to what you'd think of as either a firm tofu texture or a sort of light, cloud-like tofu texture.
How is it presented?
You can get either a full basket's worth or a half basket's worth. You can get it just absolutely straightforward. You can dribble on, you know, some of the flavored vinegars they have or the salt flavored with green tea. You can get what they call oyaji tofu. It means like old guy tofu. It means like the way that Gramps likes it or something.
And how does Gramps like it?
Apparently he likes it with some wilted mustard greens and with the Japanese equivalent of the North Chinese condiment called spicy chili crisp.
I'm so addicted to that stuff.
Spicy chili crisp is just the best.
We could just do a whole segment on that, which we should do one day.
Yeah.
I'm addicted. Anyway, oh, that's interesting. I didn't know there was a Japanese version of that.
I didn't either, but there it is.
And old Gramps knows his stuff.
Yeah, and there's even a little bit of the mala, that sort of tingly Sichuan pepper thing going on there.
Wow. Interesting.
Probably the star of it, though I end up getting it less often, is the agadashi tofu, which is to say that tofu, which is deep fried, put on a plate in a kind of broth.
So delicious.
So good.
So I find that I can often go crazy in izakaya places because I tend to want, ooh, that's really soft and custardy. Ooh, that's going to be nice and crisp. Oh, that's going to have a little bit of char. Do you have a template for ordering?
Usually when I go to this place or places like this, I will get three or four of the skewers. And some of the skewer things are pretty straightforward, like chicken thigh or chicken wing or tsukune, which is ground chicken. Their chicken is great. It's fluffy. It's shaped to look kind of like a miniature Louisville Slugger. It has little crispy things chopped into it. Just a delicious bite. And then they have some things that are a little, I don't know if they're odder, I guess, but like duck breast with a little bit of soy sauce, you know, cooked down with balsamic vinegar, or fish belly. You've got to get the fish belly. Fish belly's good. It's super crisp on the outside and rich and melting on the inside.
Yum.
Also, asparagus wrap with bacon, because it's asparagus wrap with bacon. They also do one thing I'd never seen before, though it seems so obvious, but they have bits of chicken and then they wrap the skin around it as if it's a wonton wrapper, and then they grill it and the skin becomes super crisp. And even though the meat inside is breast meat and thus boring, somehow it acquires almost a different dimension.
That's a great idea. What else did you have? Do they do a lot of vegetables in interesting ways?
There are fewer vegetables there than you might imagine. There's usually a grilled Japanese eggplant. It's basic, but it's nice. There's grilled mushrooms, the shishito peppers that everybody has. There's one salad that I thought was fascinating. It's very much a Caesar salad. They call it dried tatami salad.
Hmm.
And the tatami is made of, you know, baby sardines that have been pressed into a mat and then dried. So they're very light and crispy, like half a Triscuit cracker or something, but with that sort of sardine umami taste. It's a Caesar salad. It's romaine lettuce with like a Parmesan dressing. So it's like something you've had a million times, but there's that twist to it that makes it a little bit different.
They've combined the crouton and the anchovy.
Exactly.
That's great.
One of the things that everybody loves there is the chawanmushi, which is the steamed custard, that they blend a little bit of foie gras into the egg. So there's just a hint of that flavor without its sort of punishing richness.
But it does enrich what would be a rich, luxurious custard.
It does. If you're having it at the end of the meal when you get the rice and the noodles traditionally, you can get that with an inch or so of broth and some cold udon noodles. They call them udon noodles, to dip into the hot broth, which is a really nice combination.
So any town would be happy to have raku arrive. Given that we have so many izakayas here in LA, is it like a huge step up from other things we're experiencing?
There's a lot of good izakayas in Los Angeles. And in a town like Las Vegas, where there are no izakayas, it's the best one in town by a lot. Here, it's probably top five, but it's not head and shoulders above some of the places that we know and love. One of the other things I love there is they call it fried ice fish. And usually I think of ice fish as something different, but these are tiny, translucent little white bait, I guess, that are fried and very light and they're very delicate and crunchy. But it always makes me think of French fries with eyes.
All righty then. So let's turn towards the end of the meal when you say you go for rice and noodles. What kind of rice and noodles?
They're the dons, the rice bowls. So the oyoko don, which is, I guess, translates to what, mother and child. So it's egg and chicken on top of rice, which is fun. You can get one with foie gras. There are grilled rice balls, which you get in broth, which you can get with, you know, ume, the delicious pickled plum. The best way to end a meal there, I think, is with kamameshi, which isn't on the menu, so you have to remember it. Kamameshi.
Kamameshi. What is kamameshi?
Kamameshi is kind of a wet Japanese pilaf cooked and comes to table in a heavy iron pot. And there's salmon and there's herbs and there's roe and there's all kinds of things in it. It's just this big, satisfying heap of rice. And you would think that it would be heavy, but because of the lightness of the herbs and the flavorings, it doesn't taste heavy at all. It's really good.
Sounds like a great place to have a really good meal.
A good place to splash out.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thanks so much.
That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Aburiya Raku in West Hollywood. Text the words good food to 69866, and you will get a text with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes. In a minute, we hear about a fruit that's invading kitchens and menus across the country. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
Summer girl, and my favorite thing in bring for me is avocado. Avocado, my love, the avocado.
That's Jamaican singer Janine Cunningham, who goes by the name Ja 9. Her song is an homage to the avocado, and she's not the only fan of this green fruit. We Los Angelinos eat more avocados than residents of any other American city. And not just that mainstream Haas avocado with its pebbly, thick, dark skin. Let's go to the Santa Monica Farmers Market to learn more.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm talking right now with Kevin Meehan, who is the chef owner of Cali Restaurant, which is located up at Melrose and Larchmont. They've been open about a month. And Kevin, you're talking about the avocados you like right now.
Laura Ramirez's Fuerte Avocados. What winds my clock about her avocados are that they're really creamy. They're always ripe. You can kind of give them different degrees as well. A lot of people sometimes buy, you know, 10 ripe avocados at the same time, and they're all ripe. So you can kind of, you know, also get a case of unripe and a case of ripe and kind of spread them out throughout the week of the restaurant, which is, you know, obviously good for food costs and not wasting stuff. What I love about the avocados, though, is that they're really creamy.
Most people like that Haas, which is the one with the bubbly skin, the kind of the thick black skin. I know shippers like it because it never shows the bruises and the spots. So your Fuerte, that's a thin green skin, and is it the dull or the shiny?
It's a thin green skin. It's dull, and it's not the prettiest looking avocado either. And truth be told, when like you kind of cut it in half and remove the pit, there are like bruises and blemishes in it. And that's why when I prepare at the restaurant, I kind of do it in such a way where it's not diced up and put on top of like a ceviche where it's like, behold, bright green avocado. What we do is actually we take the avocado, I cut it in half, I remove the pit, and then I squeeze some lemon juice on it. Then I take avocado honey, which then I brush on top of it, and then I take a hot pan and I use avocado oil, of course, and salt and pepper, and then I sear the avocados and I char it black. I caramelize the honey on top of the flat side of the avocado that I cut that was exposed, and I leave them like that. And what I do is I make a salad and with Maggie's Farms. I get some baby kale from them and shaved vegetables inside there, and then I use the Santa Barbara Pistachio Company. I make a pistachio kind of like a remoulade with pistachio oil, and I toss and pretty much make a like an avocado sandwich with all the shaved vegetables and the kale, and I dust it with black garlic ash on top. So it's very approachable. It's a delicious salad. It also has a wow factor of like, ooh, wow, this is a fancy-looking restaurant with a fancy salad. So I think a lot of the guests really enjoy it. And at the end of the day, it's a really healthy, beautiful salad as well.
It sounds amazing, and it probably looks beautiful. When you're searing that avocado upside down, is the skin still on?
Skin's still on, because avocado is obviously slimy and mushy. And the skin, when you leave it on, you can sear it all four sides of the avocado. If you take the whole thing out, that's fine, too. You know, you could do a big dice of avocado and sauté them. A lot of people never really had hot avocado as well, or warm avocado or charred avocado. But I leave the skin on, and we do them like pretty much before service. We leave them on, and then to order, like order in one avocado and one soup, we'll take a spoon and carefully scoop out, you know, the avocado. And so you have a nice bright green exposed side, but the other side doesn't get oxidized.
Yeah, and as the avocados now, eventually that Fuerte is going to evolve out into another variety. There'll be another variety coming along. Or has Laura told you that she'll have those all year round?
No, they're not going to be around all year round. But I would just do a different salad and move on to something else. I can easily just do, you know, I'll do a caramelized peach salad with the same thing. You know, I get the same effect from having a delicious, juicy, ripe peach. And I'd probably, you know, I could do that or any other thing or just do a different salad, you know, and just move on.
Right. Well, that sounds very inspiring, very delicious. And the whole concept of a hot cooked avocado absolutely sounds great. So thank you so much for that.
All right. You're welcome.
That was Kevin Meehan. He is the chef owner of Cali Restaurant, located at Melrose and Larchmont. The restaurant's been open for about a month, and clearly Kevin is passionate about his cooking and his food, and we love him because he supports the farmer's market. We're talking now with Laura Ramirez, who's the farmer that Kevin talked about at JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch. She grows out in San Bernardino County, grows several varieties of avocados. Now, Laura, I think I'm like a lot of people. I never really paid much attention to the Fuerte. You really like it. Kevin likes it. What's so great about the Fuerte?
Well, besides it being my dad's favorite, you know, he always loved it. It's one of the original varieties, creamy, wonderful. It makes great guacamole. And when you cut into it, it doesn't quite oxidize as much as the rest. So I just love it. You know, it's always my favorite.
You were telling us it got the name because it was the sole survivor of a killing freeze here in California.
That's true. And, you know, Fuerte means strong in Spanish, so it survived a lot. It was one of the first varieties out here in Santa Monica, and it was the go-to for many, many years until the Hass came along and bumped it off of its number one spot.
Right. And why do you think that happened?
Well, I think that happened because the Fuerte is very thin skin, and at the grocery store, if you drop it on the ground and do anything to it, it's going to bruise up so badly that it looks terrible. And I'm sure there was a lot of loss. And when the Hass came around, it was dark skinned, and, you know, it hides a lot of sins under there. So,
right. You grow also Pinkerton, and you've got some other varieties. Is there a season to the avocados?
There is a season. You know, we grow over 20 different varieties, so we have something all year long. And we were mentioning the Pinkerton. The Pinkerton is a combination between Hass and Fuerte, so it's a nice one also. Small seed, long neck. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good choice also this time of year.
And it's very important to pick the avocado when it has enough oil content. You can't really tell when it's on the tree because it'll still be green and hard and hanging on a tree. But there does come a point where it has developed enough oil that it can then become fully ripe and flavorful.
Right. The government actually tells us when we can actually pick those avocados, when there's enough oil. And actually, the avocado doesn't get ripe until you pick it from the tree. That's the one thing. You can hang it on the tree until you want to eat it or until the oil is ready, but you have to pick it. It's not tree ripened.
Okay, so you know it's ready to pick after the avocado commission has said yes, and it starts out by the size, like this many ounces, that many ounces, when they get bigger and bigger. And then so the customer is protected from ever getting a rubber avocado.
Exactly, and the people come around from the ag department and check to make sure we have all our exemption certificates and everything to make all the farmers legit.
Laura, you're out in San Bernardino County. It's been so hot lately. How do you deal with your water situation?
Well, you know, we're all getting our allotments cut on our water. But what we have done this past year is we built a great big debris basin to catch all the water, and we're kind of making it into a big pond and trying to utilize the water that way.
So that'll catch rainwater and irrigation runoff, anything at all, and then you pump it back out onto your trees.
Exactly. So that's been our solution, and it's been helping us.
Okay. And this little bit of rain.
And the little bit of rain, any little bit. Hopefully we'll get it.
Yeah. And so I gotta confess, I was a Hass lover, and I am going to buy me some Fuertes today, and I'm going to check them out.
Oh, yeah. Just remember, they were my dad's favorite, so that means they're number one.
Okay. All right, Laura. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's Laura Ramirez. She is JJ's Lone Daughter Ranch, and she comes from San Bernardino County. We didn't even talk about the bacons and the other varieties. She said she grows over 20 varieties of avocados, and she sells at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Markets. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Did you know that there were so many varieties of avocados, or that you could eat them hot? We've got a recipe for Kevin Meehan's charred avocado salad on the Good Food blog. Up next, we get the hard sell for making food at home from a cheese nun, a barbecue pit master, and some Aboriginal Gowanna hunters. Stick with
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I grew up at a time when, for the most part, if you wanted to eat, someone had to cook. But today, many of us rely on others to make nearly all the food we eat. Even Michael Pollan, the great food thinker, didn't cook much until he decided it was time to learn. That deep dive into the kitchen resulted in his 2013 book, Cooked. Now, the ideas he explored in Cooked are showcased in a stunning new Netflix documentary series. It gives us the perfect reason to speak to the man. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Evan. Good to be back.
Yeah, I always look forward to talking with you. This conundrum of how we cook less as we watch other people cook more is so odd.
It's a paradox. It makes very little sense. But today there are millions of people who spend more time watching other people cook on television than they spend cooking themselves, something they could do. And, you know, I don't have to point out that the food they watch being cooked on television, they don't get to taste.
Which just seems so insane to me.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, we are lazy. So you do get to just lie there on the couch and watch people cook. But such a big part of cooking is the anticipation of eating. So I don't exactly get that.
I understand that for most of your life, you were lucky to be surrounded by people who are really good cooks. So you didn't really have to think about it very much. And you actually came to cooking by thinking about it through a more intellectual lens, which is so geeky. I love it.
It is a little geeky, but it really grew out of my work writing about the food system and trying to understand why we had transformed our food system in ways that were so destructive of the environment and so destructive of our health. And the more I looked at it, you know, when I started looking at farms, and I really did, my exploration of food began on the soil end of the food chain, not the human end of the food chain. I realized it was the fast food industry, in large part, that had driven the industrialization of agriculture. It was the desire of McDonald's for all one kind of potato, russet Burbank, the desire for consistent supply of a certain kind of chicken and meat that had completely transformed what happened on the farm. And so I realized we were complicit in this process. The fact that we were willing to let fast food companies cook so many of our meals had led directly to this revolution in American agriculture. And so that was kind of a data point that stuck in my head. And then when I started looking at nutrition and health, and when I wrote In Defense of Food, which was really an attempt to understand, well, what should you eat if you're concerned about your health? I realized that even more important than the nutrients in determining your health or ill health was who was doing the cooking. And the people who had outsourced their cooking to large industrial corporations like McDonald's or General Mills or Unilever or whomever, they had the worst diet. And indeed, there was a direct correlation between the decline of cooking, home cooking in America, and the rise of obesity and type 2 diabetes. So then both on the health and environmental front, I realized I really had to understand this deep old human activity called cooking to understand what was going on throughout our food system.
And one of the things I think that the series does so well, because, of course, now you have the ability of visual images to enhance the story that you've been so immersed in, is you get to really see some wonderfully almost atavistic scenes. And I think about the opening sequence in the Australian bush with a group of Aboriginal hunters.
Yeah, those images are really powerful, and they do several things at once. The crew went to Western Australia, where there's a group called the Martu, who are Aboriginals, and they have been living in this very forbidding landscape of Western Australia, very dry, and using fire basically to organize their lives, to burn the landscape and to cook their food. And the Martu are hunting and gathering, much as their ancestors did for thousands of years. And by including them, we do two things. One is we immediately tell you, this is not your usual food porn, because the way they eat is not something you really want to do. I mean, their staple food, which is hunted by the women, interestingly enough, are these guana lizards that are about 4 foot long. And the women use these metal poles to find out where their burrows are and then reach their hand in, unable to see what they're doing, and grab these giant lizards by the tail, whap them on the ground, break their legs because they have these powerful claws that could cut them, and then put them over a fire. So, you know, this isn't your usual fantasy food sequence. But the other thing they do is remind us that that primal act of putting meat on fire really is where human culture begins. And for me, that was a key to unlocking the whole project of Cooked, was learning that the decisive technology wasn't just fire for our species, but it was specifically what cooking did, in that compared to the apes who eat raw food, of course, we get much more energy from our food, because when you cook food, it's much easier to digest. Essentially, you're externalizing a lot of the work of breaking down the food. It doesn't have to be chewed as much either. You don't need as elaborate a digestive system. And when we figured out that ingenious new technology is when our brains begin to grow, when we start developing things like culture and language and religion and art, and all of that we owe to cooking. And we became that rare species, in fact, the only species that must cook to survive. We actually can't survive on a raw food diet, which I'm sure some of your listeners are trying. If you were chewing all that plant material, you would not have time to do anything else, and you would use so much energy in the job of digesting your food that you wouldn't get enough to feed your brain, which is this incredible gas guzzler. I mean, your brain takes over 20% of the energy you consume in food, and it's only 2% of your body mass. So cooking is what allows us to feed our big human brains.
And one of the things that I loved about the book so much, and that I think is even more beautifully examined in the documentary because of the visuals, is this idea of transformation. And particularly in this first section in fire, you talk about how fire is related to killing, related to prestige of the person who is the one doing the cooking.
Yeah, well, the one who can manage the fire and the animal on the fire has a very high prestige in most cultures. And in fact, for many cultures, it was the priest and the butcher and the slaughterer were all the same person. And it was a very prestigious post. And eating of meat and cooking of meat was always a matter of ritual, very high ritual. This is in ancient Greece. This is in the Old Testament. And that person is the agent of transformation. You know, I've been fascinated by transformation my whole career. When I look back and I realize all my books have actually been about transformation in one way or another. And it's what we do. It's one of the things humans do. And cooking is one of the most beautiful alchemies we perform. I learned how to scramble an egg, I think, when I was in like fourth or fifth grade. I had a friend who was kind of a latchkey kid, and we would go to his house after school, and his mom worked, so there was nobody home. And so he had learned how to cook. And the thing we would always make for ourselves, because it was so magical, was scrambled eggs. And here you take this, you know, this yellow goop, and suddenly, over the fire, it suddenly becomes these, you know, beautiful yellow curds, you know, completely new form. And to me, that was kind of dazzling. And I have the same feeling now when I bake a loaf of bread, when I cook a pig in my front yard to watch that animal carcass turn into this gorgeous barbecue. It's kind of amazing, and yet we don't stop to admire it. This is very much a series about, you know, magic that's hidden in plain sight.
Yeah, I love how you talk about not only hidden from plain sight, but when you start reconnecting with the cultural aspect of cooking, you see things that now, especially given the industrialized food system, are completely hidden from our sight.
Yeah, that food connects us not just to nature, which it does on one side, you know, to the plants and animals and natural forces like fire that we command to cook. But on the other side, it connects us to people. When we learned how to cook, we began having meals. The institution of the meal didn't happen until we cooked. Before that, hunter and gatherers kind of ate whatever they could find whenever they wanted to. There was no reason to wait. There was no reason to gather people around. But cooking is a cooperative activity. Somebody had to watch the fire. Someone else had to put the meat on the fire, prepare the meat. And then you had to have all these rules to keep people from eating too soon. You know, you had to learn patience. You had to learn how to share. You had to learn how to take turns. The fire and the meal gave us so much socially, and it really is where civilization begins. The devolution of these rituals is kind of amazing to watch because you do see, as we begin to eat more processed food, we begin to eat alone more often. You know, we're eating in the car. We eat at our desks. We eat walking down the street. But the main thing is we're eating alone. So we're losing the sociality of food. And I think that's one of the most important things about it, the sharing and the generosity. You know, to cook for someone is to give them this amazing gift of love.
I think one of the most beautiful and saddest of the segments in the series was the focus on India. And wow, that opening sequence where you see this enormous pot over a fire and those spices being toasted in such quantity was just, oh, it really just gobsmacked me.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you learn about the incursion of Nestle into into such a rich food culture, that to me, it said so much about who we are and what we're willing to let happen.
Yeah. Well, you know, what you see in the film is, and the filmmakers got incredible access to Nestle, and you see this group of Indian food scientists and chefs trying to bring the Indian flavor palette to this pretty crappy product called Maggi noodles, which are this cross-cultural junk food. I mean, it has very little nutritional value. It's all sort of refined carbohydrates and chemical flavoring, basically. But it's incredibly cheap, and it's being eaten all over the world. And they are now intent on adapting their product to the Indian palate and getting Indians to give up what is one of the most beautiful, richest, most diverse food cultures on the planet. I'm not entirely sure they will succeed. I think the Indians will defend their food culture more vigorously than a great many cultures. I know from my own experience with Indian students in my classes here at Berkeley, many of them bring their tiffins to school. They don't want to eat what everyone else is eating. And many of them will tell me they're still cooking in the morning before they go to school, toasting their spices every morning and grinding them fresh. This is an extraordinary tenacity around their food culture. So I'm hoping that they'll battle Nestle and succeed. What you see in the film, too, is this brilliant adaptation to the reality of people working and not having time to cook, you know, a meal before they go to work, and that there are these collective kitchens where fresh curries and naan breads and other foods are prepared for hundreds, if not thousands, of people and then delivered in tiffins to people's place of work, arriving still piping hot. It's a different approach to industrializing food, but it's not processed food. It's the real thing, distributed in a new way, involving, you know, hundreds and thousands of people every day. And it's all delivered by tiffins on bicycles. It's quite beautiful. And it suggests that there may be other ways to solve this problem than we have heretofore figured out in this country. And for us, it's, you know, move toward microwavable food. But maybe there's another way to do it.
In the episode which focused on air, you had this marvelous baker from Massachusetts who spoke very deeply and movingly about the transformation of basically just flour and water into something completely indigestible, into something totally nutritious.
Yeah, the making of bread, which is one of the most powerful technologies our civilization has hit upon. When I was researching the book, there's a food scientist at Davis named Bruce German, and he said, you know, if I gave you a bag of flour, even whole grain flour and water, You could live for a while on that, and that's all you had, but you would eventually die. It doesn't have everything you need. But if you took the same bag of flour and water and transformed it into bread, you could live indefinitely. And to me, it seemed like it was the same stuff, right? I mean, that flour and water equals bread. But in fact, the making of the bread is such a radical transformation in terms of the nutritiousness. And why is that? Well, first you have this sourdough culture, which goes about breaking down the polymers, the long chain carbohydrates and proteins in flour, which are kind of locked up. Flour is crushed grass seed, and its intent is to help a new plant. And it has everything a new life needs, but it's trying to protect it against animals eating it or anybody else eating it, bacteria. So it locks up all those nutrients in these long chains, which we can't get into. But the sourdough culture, all those bacteria and fungi put enzymes out that start breaking down the polysaccharides and make them available to us. And so that's one step. And then the next step is when you bake the bread, the loaf of bread is like a pressure cooker. The crust of the bread keeps the heat inside and the steam inside. And every one of those air pockets created by the fermentation steams up to a temperature far beyond the boiling point. So you can thoroughly cook the starches. Between the heating of the bread, the steaming of the starches, and the breaking down of the starches and the proteins by the microbes, you've transformed that flour into something with the power to keep human beings alive.
Did you ever imagine that you'd be able to just put together a loaf of bread?
No. I really thought baking bread was the kind of rocket science of cooking. I mean, you had to know the metric system. You had to use scales calculated in grams. And have you ever looked at baker's math? I mean,
it's
bread
insane,
recipes.
Right?
It's insane, right? It's absolutely insane. It's all in terms of percentages. But the percentages add up to more than 100. And it takes a very long time to get your head around that. So the whole thing was incredibly intimidating. And I started with a very difficult recipe. I wanted to learn the tartine loaf.
You're insane.
That Chad Robert. It's like a 27-page recipe, but, you know, it was worth it. And I can't say I've mastered it, but I can bake it with some success. And in fact, that recipe is descended from Richard Borden, the baker in the film, who's this wonderful French-Canadian baker in Housatonic, Massachusetts, who is just so committed to fermentation and has so mastered the process. This was the man who taught Chad Robertson how to bake. And Chad is the legendary San Francisco baker who I apprenticed myself to when I was writing Cooked. And Chad was at the CIA. He was learning how to be a chef, and they took a field trip up to Richard's bakery. And after a couple hours in the presence of Richard Borden, Chad changed his life course and decided, I'm going to be a baker. And Richard is that passionate and that kind of evangelical on the subject of fermentation and baking. And to watch him is to think there's nothing more important to do in life than to bake a good loaf of bread.
I have to say that after binge watching all four segments of the show, I came away with this incredible awe in just human ingenuity in how we learn to care for one another. To me, that's really what Cooked is all about.
It is a story about our social life. It's a story about something that connects us in a profound way. And it's a reminder that food is not just fuel, and we're even just entertainment. I mean, and that's what we're being encouraged to think. It's just fuel. Grab that cereal bar on the way out. But in fact, it's the connective tissue of our lives, eating meals together. One of the great achievements, I think, of the filmmakers and improvements over the book is that they internationalized the story. So that every one of the four episodes goes to some destination, whether it's Peru in the fermentation section Earth, or India in the water section, or Western Australia in the fire section, and Morocco in the bread section. And we're reminded that this is not just an American story, that the story of cooking is one of the deep common denominators of our humanity. And, you know, the film really celebrates that. You know, it's not just the food. It's what happens around the food. It's the meal.
That was Michael Pollan talking about his new documentary series, Cooked. You can watch it on Netflix now. There's a trailer on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com via iTunes or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. Many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camelia Tse, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.